This is London calling North America. The British Broadcasting Corporation presents now London Letter. Every week at this time, MacDonald Hastings writes you his letter in which he tells you what he's been doing, the people he's met, and gives you a general picture of life in London.
Hello, folks. Last night, at a London movie theatre, I went back 6 or was it 7 years. I watched a revival of Ernest Hemingway's documentary of the Spanish Civil War. He called it The Spanish Earth. Remember it? It was a strange experience seeing it again. I remember that when the picture was first shown, we all felt that it was one of the starkest records of human suffering and human endurance ever made. Yet last night, when I looked at it again, I was astounded that it could ever have seemed so horrific as it did. The air raids on Madrid, which seemed so terrible at the time, were so trifling by comparison with what we're used to now that we shouldn't call them raids at all. Nowadays, the communiques would just say that a few raiders appeared over the Madrid area. And as I looked at the screenshots made 6 years ago, I couldn't help wondering what would have happened to us in London if during those past 4 years we'd scurried to shelter every time there was a bang in the vicinity or a raider overhead. The Londoners sitting around me in the movie theatre were feeling just the same about it as I was. I heard somebody behind me saying, "It's difficult to appreciate what all the fuss is about." And a man in uniform next door to me leant over to his girlfriend during one of the battle sequences and remarked, "It was a pretty primitive kind of war, wasn't it?" Primitive. So it was, by our standards. A few obsolete tanks, old-fashioned artillery, and an air force which altogether couldn't put up what we'd call a sizable raid on London. Primitive. What a pass we've come to in a mere 5 years. When Hemingway's record of the Spanish Earth was first screened, it tore our hearts and gave us a new conception of horror. Now, so inured are we to horror that the Spanish Civil War seems outmoded. Solemn thought. The way it is, I suppose, is that one can become accustomed to anything. In Normandy, I remember seeing a flaxen-haired little girl. She couldn't have been more than 6 or 7. A little French girl with a broken doll in her arms. She was gazing at the corrupted remains of a dead German. And she was looking at that thing absolutely without any emotion at all. And it was a spectacle which was ugly enough to make a grown man faint. After the war, one of the great personal problems which each of us faces in Europe is to recover our sense of human values. And not only in our outlook to horror, but in other things too. Somebody said to me not long ago, Courage is the cheapest commodity in the world today. You see how it is. Habit is teaching us even to make light of the great human virtues. The moral is easy. We can go on having wars and man will survive them. But if we do go on having wars, we shan't be able to call ourselves human beings much longer. Well, that's enough of that. I'm getting serious again. And surely we can all hope that the worst horrors of this war are behind us. The struggle now is to recover ourselves to live decently again. And at the moment, London is intimately concerned with just that problem. I've talked to you before about the tremendous problem of mending London after the 4 years' succession of air raids. But it's impossible not to keep on talking about it, because the discomfort and distress of thousands of London families whose homes have been blitzed, it's one of the most serious situations that we're up against on this side of the Atlantic today. Somehow we've got to make thousands of damaged homes habitable for the winter. The people who escaped with their lives from the flying bombs last summer are now facing the dangers of winter cold, damp, drafts, and rain. We're having a race, literally a race, between repairs and disease. And as a member of Parliament said last week, no serious person can say yet which of them, repairs or disease, is going to win. It's a serious, a very serious battle. Very few Londoners realize what large forces the government are mobilizing to fight it. The building repair army in London has been increased in recent weeks from 24,000 to 132,000 men. And that represents 40% of the total building industry of the United Kingdom. Of these men, 85,000 of them are craftsmen, just under half of our national building strength. The armed services have released 6,000 men. The National Fire Service is 2,300. Hotels and big mansions have been taken over as barracks to house the workers. Temporary hutting is being got ready in case the work can't be completed in time. And while families are waiting to have roofs repaired and windows put in, they're making shift with tarpaulins and boarding. Others are making their homes in air raid shelters, as they did in the Blitz. And while the fight's been going on, we've had a nasty setback, only this week, from the weather. Over the weekend, an 80-mile-an-hour gale swept over England and caused immense damage to the work that's already been done. The wind tore tarpaulins off roofs, carried down damaged slates and chimney pots, tore boards out of glass-shattered windows. Scaffolding was hurled into the streets, and in many places windows were just put in, were blown out again before the putty had time to set. It's a grim business. And it has a direct bearing on our war effort, on the Allied war effort, because if there's anything that the strategy of this war has taught us, it's how much depends on London's continued strength and vigour. And believe me, London in the whole of this war has never been so troubled with her domestic health as she is at this moment. With the housing shortage so acute, well, we can afford to laugh at our clothes shortage. And every husband over here has got a laugh on his wife this week. The Board of Trade, that's the government department which is responsible for clothes rationing, has just come out with statistics which reveal that the woman over here who says, "I haven't a thing to wear," is only 4% nearer the truth than she was 3 years ago. On practically every count, it's been discovered that after 4 years of clothes rationing, wives have got bigger wardrobes than their husbands. Not that that means much by peacetime standards. According to official calculations, the average woman in Britain now has 2.5 pairs of stockings, 4 dresses, and 1.1% of corsets. And by the way, the girl who holds my hand when I'm broadcasting says there's absolutely no elastic in the corsets at all, not even 0.1%. So, as men are said to be worse off, you can guess what we're reduced to. As a matter of fact, I think most of us men have been living on our fat. Personally, and being rather prodigal about buying clothes, I actually had 19 shirts when rationing came in. I wore those until the cuffs and collars were frayed, and then I took them to the shirt maker, who used one to repair the others and handed me back 10 wearable shirts out of the original 19. Well, those 10 shirts lasted for a couple of years, and they've just gone back to the shirt makers again. And I'm informed that by using one to patch the others, there'll be 4 shirts left. And with those 4 shirts, the survivors of the original 19, I've somehow got to survive the war. And I'm one of the lucky ones. Most men these days are hanging out with 2. Of course, we have been able to buy new clothes. Those of us who've been able to get hold of our clothes ration book before our wives have used up all the coupons. And the wives usually have to spend them not on themselves, but on the children, because a school wardrobe actually calls for the equivalent of 6 people's ration. But then the ration isn't intended to renew wardrobes. It's only intended to stop up the gaps. One big gap, like a winter overcoat, well, that uses up all the coupons you've got. So, when we've bought anything new, most of us have concentrated on buying something to last. And experience has taught us that the best possible material is corduroy. And as a result, corduroy, which before the war was worn only by laborers and bohemian gentlemen with long hair, corduroy has become our wartime fashion. Everybody wears it. Even General Montgomery has corduroy trousers. And in London, you see men with corduroy suits, even corduroy overcoats. And women, too. For women, all sorts of colored corduroys have been produced. My wife wears plum-colored trousers made of it. And it's surprising how smart it looks. In fact, corduroy has become so popular that now, inevitably, there's a shortage. And the government has had to reserve available stocks for industrial workers only. Still, I've got mine. And by the look of things, I'll be wearing them hard these next few weeks. I'm on my way to the battle in Holland. And although it's against the regulations to wear corduroys with uniform, well, it's one of those regulations which in the battlefield everybody ignores. And in the battlefield as wet as I'm told the Dutch one is, I should say anything goes that's dry. Still, I hope to give you some front-line news about it next week. This talk will be called the London Letter, just the same. But I'll be broadcasting not from London, but I hope from Brussels. Till then, goodbye, folks.
You have been listening to a recording made by MacDonald Hastings before he left for Holland. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.